Nenganda. Maybe you should start the DG. Otherwise, anyway, you are in your territory here. We feel a little bit overwhelmed by your territory. That's why you must come to Parliament. You mustn't come here. Come to our territory there. Melham is there. I think he's very happy. And then his friend now is redeployed. And then we should start, colleagues, and sorry that we have delayed the meeting for some time. We didn't have venues in Parliament. All committees are meeting. Then instead of going to a hotel, we felt that at least we should be accommodated here in the department. Unfortunately, also there was a meeting, and we have to wait for some time, and they are sorry for this. You know that honorable members, they've got other commitment. At least at one, the latest would be one. We wanted to have a very detailed meeting by the department on issues that are relevant for us. I think we can do that. Our agenda is very one important state of the nation address on local government. Other matter, of course, just for 10 minutes be municipal structures amendment bill. Just those are the issues there. We are mindful that the new minister is and deputy ministers, Owen Papele, Honorable Nell. I know that the minister, I'm told, that is in the cabinet meeting. Deputy minister, Papele, I think, on the leave. Honorable Nell is having a meeting here. But the DG is here, and I think we can be able to have a meeting and have a briefing. I think members won't have a problem. I know that as a principle, generally we are briefed by political head of department, general. But it was explained the reason why, and we thought that there's no harm for DG to come and brief us. But generally we always push that, because people who account to us, broadly speaking, are political deployees here, ministers, deputy ministers, and another person. But we always allow space like this where under circumstances. I think we can continue with our meeting, and not sure what is the time now, just to, I know that there are two main other meetings. It's almost 11 now. I think we can start with our meeting, unless there are other apologies.
Apology from Mr. Talisa. You won't be able to make the meeting today.
Alisa? Okay. Doesn't attend anyway many meetings. Another apology? Can we start then with our briefing by the department? DG, always good to introduce yourself. It's the first meeting we are meeting with you. Some members may know you in other capacity, but the DG is the first meeting we're meeting with you. It would be then wonderful if you can introduce yourself for all members to know who is you exactly. And then you can then take us through with your team. We know the team, we've been meeting with them several times, but no harm again to introduce themselves. Just to ensure that we know exactly who's here.
Thank you, Chairperson, and the honorable members of the committee. My name is Dan Magic Bishop. I have joined the department on the 1st of December. And briefly, maybe just on my background, I've been in local government basically for as old as the new democracy is, about 23, 24 years. I was in local government, counting government, counting province, as director, then chief director, then acting head of department sometime for 10 years in Saudi. Then I then was the municipal manager for 12 years, 10 years in Mukhari City, and then 2 years in Rapo.
Is that 42 years too?
Yes, that's the and of course I was in the Department of Water and Sanitation for a short period of time. That was basically last year as the DC there. So that just briefly about myself, Jefferson. And I think we should start by apologizing for the venue conundrum. We apologize. And I'm sure the DM may have also spoken to I think there was some confusion. We apologize. And then in terms of the team, team is mainly DCOC. As you know, the department is too, so it's mainly DCOC. I will allow the members just to put their stay with the app, and then we can start.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Mamapule Josity from DCOC.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Tebo Komotasoping from IDA Finance DCOC.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. My name is Chovani. My surname is Mateza. I'm in the ministry.
Good morning, members and chairperson. My name is Mariki Krier. I work for the branch local government support and implementation in DCOC.
Good morning. I'm Kevin Naidu. I work in a unit called municipal government.
Good morning, chairperson, honorable members. I am not with DCOC. My name is Granville Edwards. I'm with the Independent Electoral Commission.
Good morning, members. My name is Kevin Judy. I'm the parliamentary officer, Office of the DG.
Okay, thank you very much, DG, for the introduction. We can invite you then to take your platform and brief us on issues that you wanted to brief us on.
Thank you, Chairperson. Regarding Sona, we'll ask Dr.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, DG. I'm going to jump right into to the presentation and make it short with the implications, focusing on the implications for the department and not all the introductory slides. So I would like to go to slide 13, please, where we are starting with the implications for local government. In this regard, the SONA did not have directly addressing local government as such, but there are a number of COCTA programs which needs to be strongly directed to support the direction of government as set out by the President. In this regard, we are looking at radical economic transformation, for example, where municipalities have an important role to play in promoting radical economic and social transformation. We are looking here at specifically using tools such as integrated development planning, land use management, the IUDF, and the LEDs framework. COCTA has a key role to play in implementing the Back to Basics program to improve the functionality of local government. And the second phase here includes a number of aspects, including strengthening the issue of the IUDF implementation and revitalizing the LED, the Local Economic Development Framework. There was a national conference on the LED where the focus is on collaboration, which also came out collaborative partnerships in the SONA, as well as integrated place development, The whole issue of state-led, private sector-driven, community-based development and inclusive economy that prioritizes those that have been marginalized in the past. Secondly, we are also looking at good governance. Good governance needs to focus here from the COCTA side on really managing the implementation of forensic reports, for example. That's the next slide. Thank you. Slide 15. Yeah. And we need to look at strengthening financial management and financial viability, looking at revenue enhancement programs and consistently looking at the disclaimer audit opinions, where we need to focus on that. Next slide, thank you. We are also looking at institutional efficiencies, and the second phase of Back to Basics here focus on improvement of complaints management systems in municipalities and regular feedback to communities, and also building the institutional capabilities, focusing on the strengthening of our IGR, relooking the roles of district municipalities and strengthening provincial COCTAs. We are also there strengthening the monitoring of compliance with the requirements for the appointment of senior managers in municipalities. Then linking to infrastructure supporting the economy, we are looking at prioritizing capacity for services and infrastructure delivery in our municipalities, specifically looking at maintenance of our infrastructure, existing infrastructure, and making the municipal infrastructure procurement more efficient and effective, also increasing access to quality, reliable, and sustainable basic levels of service in the 27 prioritized districts. COCTA has here intervened in cases of non-performance of municipalities by stopping the MIG allocation and through evoking Section 19 of DORA. In this regard, I also want to link immediately to the implications of the budget on the MIG and looking at the reduction of the municipal infrastructure grant over the next 3 years of the MTF. It's going to be reduced. And there's also the implication of the VAT, the value-added tax, which has increased from 14% to 15%. So there are a number of issues regarding the budget that impact on our infrastructure delivery. Then lastly, we are looking at the disaster management, specifically linking to the SONAR. The second phase, Back to Basics here, has emphasized the need to strengthen the resilience that we have and the adaptation to environmental changes. And we're also looking at the classification of national disaster, which is actually the primary responsibility of the national executive in this regard. And we have recently then classified the current drought as a national disaster. Looking at the budget highlights, the division of revenue over the next 3 years, 48% of nationally raised funds are allocated to national government, 43% to provincial, and 9% to local government. And there was an indication that although government would like to allocate more money to the local government sphere, the reality is that the rising cost of servicing the national debt leaves less resources available to invest in services across the three spheres of government. So the budget review indicated that allocations to the local government equitable share will grow by an average of 7.5% over the MTF period. An amount of $3.4 billion is added to the local government equitable share over the medium term, which is going to cover the free basic services to a growing number of households fully. The addition also allows for faster increases in the allocation to poorer rural municipalities through the redistributive components of the equitable share formula. Indirect grants, however, have been reduced by an additional $2.2 million. But we see we lose a little bit, $2.2 million, and we gain the $3.4 billion over the period. However, the structure of the formula used to allocate the grant reduces the impact of the reductions to smaller municipalities. There's also envisaged by 2019-20 a new integrated urban development grant. Cities that meet planning and performance criteria to qualify will receive this grant, which will be funded through a shift of funds from the MIG, the Municipal Infrastructure Grant. Then we are saying municipalities have the potential, and this is where we need to focus to strengthen municipalities to be able to really use the available options that they have to leverage more of their own revenue. So the total value of outstanding long-term municipal debt increased to 66.3 billion in the first quarter of 2017-18, but the proportion of municipal capital budgets funded from borrowing has fallen from 24% to 15% in 2016-17. So we need to strengthen the own revenue sources and ensure that the debt is improved, the debt situation. Regulatory changes is envisaged that can help municipalities to make better use of their own revenue potential. Government will table amendments to the Municipal Fiscal Powers and Functions Act to clarify the rules for levying these charges. Then National Treasury is also updating the policy framework on municipal borrowing. Changes to the clauses of the Division of Revenue Bill remove provisions that only allow municipalities to borrow against future grant transfers for 3 years and required an onerous approval process. Instead, municipalities will be able to borrow against all their future revenues, subject to the requirements of the Municipal Finance Management Act. There's also the issue of too many municipalities not charging tariffs that reflect the full costs of services. And not collecting the funds that are owed to them. In this regard, the back to basics will continue through provincial steering committees and support to improve the municipality's ability to collect funds and their budgeting processes. Although national government already provides extensive capacity support to municipalities, the effectiveness of these different support measures will be reviewed and a new instrument will be introduced designed to assist turnaround of some of the most troubled municipalities. At the end of 2017, 20 municipalities were the largest outstanding commitments owed creditors, 17.4 billion, but had only 1.7 billion cash on hand. Most of these debts are owned to Eskom and water boards. There's also the issue of protracted non-payment that undermines the financial sustainability of these utility-state-owned entities. National and provincial departments also own municipalities, and the Department of Public Works is working to verify and settle these debts. To date, debts totaling $4 billion have been verified, and departments have paid $1.6 billion owned.
No, so we only ended up in slide 22. Going forward, we don't have those slides.
On slide 25.
We only have
up to 22.
Okay, we'll be looking on the bicycle for there.
Should I continue or should we rather continue? Non-payment of creditors is a symptom, unfortunately, of deeper underlying problems. And these include weaknesses in revenue collection, underinvestment, and in maintenance and renewal. Too many municipalities fail to adopt credible budgets, meaning that even if they stick to their budgeted plan, they will not be financially sustainable. In 2017, only 125 municipalities tabled funded budgets, but the number increased to 145 after some benchmarking and support from National Treasury and Provincial Treasuries. In 2017-18, 81 municipalities voted to adopt budgets that they knew were not funded, making some form of financial stress inevitable. The causes of municipal financial crisis are complex, and the response needs to be considered very carefully. Government spends nearly $2 billion a year on municipal capacity support. National and provincial treasuries and other departments provide oversight and support through the system of cooperative governance, and in this regard, the IGR and the steering committees in provinces and with municipalities are extremely important. Where municipalities consistently fail to achieve their mandates, the Constitution provides that provinces and or national government must intervene. Government will introduce a conditional grant in the outer years of the 2018 NDF to help municipalities facing financial crisis. It would be only available to local governments that have demonstrated the political will to implement reforms necessary to turn themselves around. The grant accompanying support and intervention measures under Section 139 of the Constitution will be designed and consulted during 2018. The Minister highlighted, Minister of Treasury highlighted the need to amend the Public Audit Act to effectively address the rising trend in unauthorized, irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, and also encourage the use of public procurement as a critical lever for black economic empowerment. And the DG of National Treasury will further also issue a directive to all government departments and public institutions instructing them to pay suppliers on time or will be charging them with financial misconduct. This should be monitored by accounting offices and National Treasury will strengthen oversight mechanisms in this regard. The Minister emphasized the importance of cities in the national economy, where the South African 8 metros are home to 39% of the population but 57% of the country's economic output. In this regard, the IUDF, or Integrated Urban Development Framework, sets out government's policy commitment to improving the productivity of the urban areas. To better respond to the urban development challenges of the intermediate cities, the budget proposes to introduce a new, more flexible grant. I think I've also mentioned this grant earlier. Cities may opt to join this new grant, which will require more integrated long-term planning and a greater contribution to infrastructure investment to form their own resources. According to the budget review, the city support program has worked across national departments and metropolitan municipalities on a program to strengthen the metros as enablers of faster, more inclusive growth. To date, the significant progress has been aligning metropolitan plans to spatially targeted investment programs, preparing a portfolio of catalytic projects in each metro that will support the higher density and integrated land development, revising the public transport and housing financing arrangements to scale up delivery, and streamlining regulatory approvals to reduce the cost. Government is working with municipalities to respond to the water crisis and to provide financial assistance where necessary. The provisional allocation of 6 billion that has been set aside 2018-19 for several purposes including drought relief and to augment the public infrastructure investment. The potential job losses in vulnerable farming communities is a concern, and the option of partially mitigating these losses by temporarily increasing the intake in the Working for Water program is considered. To provide short-term assistance, the budget includes a disaster relief fund for provinces and municipalities worth 473 million rand in 2018-19. Yes, I think with that we finished.
Okay, thank you very much, DG and the team. Members, you wanted to comment? Honorable Madam.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. Could I ask that we get the comprehensive set of slides emailed to us, Shireen, as soon as possible? I do have a number of queries arising from this, and less on the state of the nation, although there are one or two issues there. The first is that the President spoke to lifestyle audits in the state of the nation. Is that something that we would be looking at rolling out to members of mayoral committees and senior officials in municipalities? And if so, how would it be implemented? Ma'am, you spoke about the drought being classified as a national disaster, and we appreciate that. However, it has not yet been declared. Is there any indication as to when that declaration will take place? Because that declaration is necessary to release the next sort of phase of support measures. Turning to the budget speech and the budget review, you mentioned that the total direct allocations to local government grows at an annual average rate of 7.5%, and that's welcome. I'm concerned that it's not enough given the growth in demand and inflationary costs. So you've got, on the one hand, you've got inflationary costs, but on the other hand, you've got a growth in demand, more people demanding more services and the rollout of more services. I'm also very concerned about the fact that the MIG is going to be substantially reduced, and I note your comment that the structure of the formula used to allocate this grant, and then the words that you highlighted, reduce the impact of reductions. That doesn't mean that they're not going to happen. That means that those smaller municipalities are still going to get less money, which means they're going to have less money to do the infrastructure upgrades that they need. I'm then very, very, very concerned about slide 22. You talk about leveraging own revenue sources through borrowing, and you also talk about opening up borrowing against future grants so that the limit of 3 years out will then fall away. Now, a little later on, you talk about the financial situation of municipalities and how 81 municipalities adopted unfunded budgets. What we're allowing municipalities to do here is dig a deeper hole. We're allowing them to effectively borrow 10 years out, I don't know how far out, and the debt repayment costs are going to cripple them. We already know of municipalities that cannot meet their debt. And I really think we need to, as a department, take a firm stance with Treasury and say we cannot allow this kind of borrowing, this unregulated incurring of debt, to allow municipalities to enter into that. In that slide, we spoke about funded budgets and unfunded budgets in 2017-18. You said that 145, give or take, 125 grouped up to 145 municipalities that had funded budgets and 81 that had unfunded budgets. What happened to the rest? We have 257 municipalities. Were the rest, didn't they pass budgets? Then, just on the interventions, and I'm very pleased to see that there is a conditional grant that is going to become available at the end of the 2018 financial year for financial crises. What I'd like to know is this. Section 1395 of the Constitution obligates the provincial and the national treasury, or the national department, to intervene in municipalities where there is a financial crisis. And section, I think it's 139 of the MFMA, makes a similar obligation, puts a similar obligation. And it outlines exactly what a financial crisis is. How many of those municipalities have had interventions in terms of section 1395? How many of those municipalities are currently under intervention? How many of them have got financial recovery plans that have been adopted by the council that are being adhered to? And if they are not being adhered to, why are they still being allowed to run their own business? Why are they not being placed under administration or dissolved? So I'd like to hear some concrete numbers. I think, Chairperson, that this committee, maybe once a month or once a quarter, should get an update as to which municipalities are under administration, which ones have had intervention in terms of financial crisis, etc. Because we cannot keep saying, well, we've got municipalities that we're intervening in. We cannot keep talking about support and municipalities. We need to take a firm hand because these municipalities are being driven into the ground. So I'd really like to see a regular report as to those municipalities. I'd just like to end off with a comment about drought. You spoke about 473 million rand for provincial and municipal drought relief. Is that over and above the disaster management contingency? And is it? And then there's 6 billion rand that includes drought relief. Does that include the 473 million rand? And can you break out that 6 billion rand a little bit broader so that we know, well, is it 1 billion rand going to drought relief? Is it 2 billion rand? How much of that 6 billion is actually going to be allocated to addressing this national crisis that you've classified but haven't declared? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Mine is on the slide 11, the state of government. I just want to know on the pertaining to the department, maybe to explain to us other issues, even though it was not touched a lot in the SONA, because the SONA might summarize issues. But most of the issues that have been dealt with there are issues on the basic issues. And then on that one, Chair, I just want to know, on your previous presentation, there were still a lot of vacancies in the department, in the municipality. How far with those programs of filling in the vacancies, including those managers that were appointed incorrectly, so who doesn't have the proper qualification or on that? And then maybe I would also want that if we can be also summarize, get a report on the second phase of the back to basis, just to another take us through in terms of the service delivery as to how far we reach. I know in the SONA it was just been touched or on the top level then.
Okay. Can we invite colleagues from the department to engage on the question that we have posed? DG and the team.
Okay. I'll attempt to answer some of the questions that my colleagues will also ask. Just on the lifestyle audit, I think that is more or less becoming a norm. So we will actually encourage that this type of a thing happens. We get a directive from the relevant authorities as to how it should go about. But I think that it is a practice that has been happening, although there's no clear guidelines as to how it should be done. But from time to time, I know that in municipalities, sometimes if there's reason to believe that there could be one of the officials or officials might be living above their means, you initiate that process. It will just depend on how rigorous we would want to do it. But I think as a department, we would definitely support that by all means. The disaster declaration, I think it is done. As far as I know from my work with DG, I know that it had passed me, went to the minister. We might just check whether it is gazetted, but I think it is at that stage. And I hope it's not caught by this process of transition. But I think it is at that level where I think the minister might actually have signed already for gazetting. But it is at that level. The grants to the municipalities will never be enough, because we have always said the fiscal policy, intergovernmental fiscal policy, needs to be amended to support the situation in the municipality. For example, if we talk of the the equitable share. We believe that the tranche that we impose to the municipalities it's like a drop in the ocean, because as you know, that equitable share excludes those people without the municipal account, which means those many people in the informal settlement, the formula doesn't cover them. And yet the constitution says you need to deliver the services to those as well, otherwise it becomes unconstitutional. So we've been thinking that the formula could be changed so that it recognizes that. So the grants are not enough. We believe that maybe there's a need just to be a little bit more innovative on how do we fund the business of local government. Because so far, we're trying, but the problems on the ground they seem to be increasing, and therefore the grants just seem not to be enough all the time. So we need to be more innovative. And I think I support Chairperson's suggestion that maybe we should report to the committee on how what efforts are we expending to assist the municipalities in all monthly basis. Because we will come with some of the innovative ways that we believe we could improve the financial situation in the municipality, especially the infrastructure, because the infrastructure generally came in the municipalities, and there's just not enough funds for that. So we'll come with innovative proposals on how it could be done. The meek reduction, you're right, it will affect the municipality. But we believe that the Minister of Finance was really, he presented a budget that had a serious deficit of what is a billion and so on, and unfortunately these cuts were in line with trying to balance the budget. So, but we believe in time we should be able to get out of that trap. Unregulated borrowing in the municipalities. Normally whoever borrows to the municipalities, they look at their credit worthiness. So most of the borrowers, even the banks and so on, they don't borrow to municipalities that are not credit worthy. And we also don't encourage it. Treasury doesn't encourage it. We know that there are organizations from outside, like they can give the municipality so many euros for infrastructure establishment and so development, but we discourage that because no municipality has the right to borrow outside and so on. So we discuss these things with the municipalities to say they shouldn't, they must look at their credit worthiness and just go following them. I think the only number of those municipalities are the 125 and then there's the deficit. So I think
I need to explain.
To address that one. My understanding of the 6 billion disaster fund is the fund that has been put in for 18, 19, but it will be over. But it's a general fund. It's not tax. It's for overall disaster. Whether it will be a fire, it will be on drought. But it's just what they put aside for disaster. And we believe it will be increased over the 20-year period. Chairperson, I think allow members to add to that.
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. I'll just respond on two issues. One in relation to the financial recovery plans. We at the department, we have since assisted, together with provincial and national treasury, we have since assisted municipalities that we have identified through the B2B classification model, through the audit outcome, and through the debt owed by municipalities to Eskom and water boards. We have since assisted municipalities to develop financial recovery plans. The minister, the Afghan minister, has done what we call provincial visits, precisely to look at how effective are those financial recovery plans in those affected municipalities per province. We have since visited 34 provinces, and we have then, subsequent to the visit by the minister, sent a technical team to go and look, to go and do an evaluation into the effectiveness of this financial recovery plan and whether those municipalities are indeed implementing those financial recovery plans. And we have now agreed that in instances where we have realized that irrespective of the fact that we have developed financial recovery plans, there is no movement in relation to the financial improvement of those municipalities, a particular different view has to be adopted. We are in the process of analyzing all the evaluation for all 9 provinces in relation to those identified strategic financial strategic municipalities. And we'll be giving the report to the portfolio committee. There will also be a point of discussion in what we call the interministerial task team to see whether these are effective and what should be done. Because we realize that developing financial recovery plans and leaving it to municipalities to implement and us not monitoring the effectiveness thereof does not bear the intended result that we have. But we will come back once we have done all the 9 provinces and indicate specifically which municipalities are implementing and what are the implementation challenges on the financial recovery plans that we have developed. But I must indicate to the committee that we have done in all identified municipalities. We have done financial recovery plans together with the assistance of the national and provincial treasurers. On the issue of the filling of vacant system in municipalities, we are doing quite well in that particular respect. I have made the presentation previously to the committee where we have indicated that we are monitoring the implementation of vacancies in municipalities, and we have given figures in that presentation in relation to the number of positions upon level has been made, and the number where we have informed MSCs and municipalities to take corrective measures in instances where appointments were not done in accordance with the regulations. And we are following this from the point of the advent. And we have recently, as far as last week, sent letters to those municipalities that did not comply with the regulations and the system set in relation to appointment of synonymizers. We are having quarterly meetings where provinces are reporting on the appointment of senior managers, and where we are indicating to them that in instances where there is no compliance, there should be corrective measures. There are 2 or 3 municipalities now that we have identified in relation to them not following the process. And we are indicating them that in the instance where there is no corrective measures, we will advise the minister to approach the court for a declaratory order. Because we have seen in the past that once we have written letters to municipalities for them to correct, they just ignore the process of them taking the matters forward. MECs, especially in the Western Cape and KZN, they've taken steps further to take the matter to court for the territorial order with numbers that indicate which municipalities where they have applied for the territorial order. Other provinces, we have indicated to them last week, 2 weeks ago, that in instances where they do not take corrective measures by other annulling, those appointments will then proceed to apply for the territorial order in this particular region. When we next appear before the committee, we will be giving you actuals in relation to the number of municipalities when we intervene and the number of appointments where we will not done in accordance with the regulations and the system.
Thank you, Chair. On the numbers there, if you calculate the 125 plus the 81, the 125 increase to 145, plus the 81 that knew that the budgets were not funded, you get to 226, which leaves us with 31. Although I'm not directly involved with this, and this was taken directly from the budget review, my feeling is that that might be municipalities at this stage that did not know that they were adopting underfunded budgets because the calculations were not correctly made, so they were not really fully aware of the fact that they were adopting underfunded budgets.
No, thank you very much. Just to say that I think one should express an appreciation for a comprehensive slide that really do cover a range of areas. So something that's just an appreciation there. The second point is the retention of this idea of self-compensation. And just to say that the need for us to be consistent in this strategy is very important. And this may provide some framework of some kind going to into the future, and that's just a comment there. But thirdly, the Chairperson, just to say that the President, in addressing the traditional, the House of Traditional Leaders, National House of Traditional Leaders, yesterday, spoke about the need to engage in the agricultural revolution. And there is also that I should call the attention of the department to that, because if this industry, a cultural revolution, is to take place, it will happen at the municipal level and happen anywhere else. And it's an idea, I think, that the department will do well to isolate and follow up, so that when the heat builds up, we need to clarify this or that. We have not found one thing, but we still kind of engage and interact with the issue. The other idea that I find very interesting is like this question of ensuring effective leadership. Leadership issues are really very ignored. And that all of us know that if we don't have effective leadership, we do very little. Then we achieve. It's a very, very important issue. The idea of sustainable development and the fourth industrial revolution, I just thought that if those two ideas can be clustered, they can lead us to. Us to begin to think about the more creative ways for the fight against corruption is something that everybody is talking about, but I think that it will do the department well to isolate the issue of corruption and begin to stick to integrate it in ongoing municipal work. In other words, I don't see the question of corruption being addressed effectively through a top-down approach, but rather that the municipalities themselves must have ethics committees and so on, not looking for work around ethics. I'm just saying that ongoing work that this committee, for instance, is doing in interacting with provinces and municipalities can be further be reinforced by work that's going on in some of the municipalities. I know, for instance, for a fact that some guys are engaged in the issue. Municipalities such as Joburg, provinces such as Kaohsiung are busy on the question on some ongoing way. So if we can integrate this work on people, that is where I go with addressing the issues. Lastly, the there's this whole question of municipalities and local governments without a tax base. It's a difficult matter, I mean, that will continue to trouble us as we move into the future. But my sense as well is that we tend to throw our arms in the air. What can we do? I don't should find space to discuss this matter and from the
I would like also to join those who are appreciating the presentation. So I've been always asking the department about the grants that they are allocating to municipalities. It seems as if it's not monitored. You know, these grants, I know they have conditions, but municipalities, they misuse these grants because they pay salaries out of these grants also. And if the department is not monitoring, then we are heading for a problem. I know that municipalities have got problem with their finances because financially some of the municipalities, they don't have, they cannot generate their own income. But the problem with these municipalities, they hire securities for the speakers, the municipal managers, the mayors. Is it allowed for the municipalities to do that? And if the department, they are not doing their work in monitoring those municipalities, I'm not sure whether they are going to sustain what they are doing. Because I think the department is only concerned about the senior management position, where you are doing well, because you always encourage the municipalities to ensure that they fill the vacancy pool of those senior managers. But we must look down at the bottom. Where are they increasing their vacancy? And do they have money to pay those people that they are hiring? The staff establishment is bloated. And what are we doing as a department to ensure that that is not done? So, Chair, I think the department must ensure that really they do monitor the grants. I'm so concerned about the grants that they are allocated to municipalities. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Chair, in every meeting, my concern becomes to see the corruption like Dr. Masondo mentioned here in the municipality. We never receive a report that also speaks to corruption. The reports that we receive are always speaking to non-recovery of monies that are not being paid by the consumers of municipal services. But that of corruption, I don't recall a report that actually speaks to corruption in the municipality. And that is a very great concern for us. I don't know whether the department is afraid of these municipalities to say to them, please come and account for the money that the Auditor General's report is saying so much in this municipality for this financial year has not been accounted for. Because monies that are not accounted for quite often are monies that, you know, just goes down the drain without any accountability. So I'm very much concerned about the issue of corruption, really. It's time that the department, you really address this issue. What do you do as a department when the Auditor General's report is saying that 200-300 million is missing at this municipality? What do you do as a department?
You just look at the report and do nothing about it. What do you do? Because this is an issue that you need to address. Your responsibility, among others, is to monitor. And monitoring means you monitor issues such as tell us, the auditor says so much is missing. Where has this money gone to? So that you interrogate people. But you operate quite far from this issue. Very far. And you talk about the means test. You are saying it is now that you are going to embark on that issue. But it has been there all these years. Municipal mayors and municipal managers, the cars they drive, the houses they build in the rural area, double stories, their salaries are not concurrent to all those things. But the department is turning a blind eye to this issue of corruption. Really, this one really needs to be addressed. Can we get assurance that in the next report, the issue of corruption will be included in your report to say we've been to this municipality, this is what the Auditor General's report is saying, and we have acted upon this issue, and this is what we got. A follow-up on issues of corruption. Otherwise, you are just, you know, pushing them under the table. You're not reporting on corruption. And that is a worrying factor. Thank you, Chair.
Just a little bit of a request to the department that maybe in our next meeting you can give us a report of municipalities that are not able to pay salaries to their staff, because we have just heard of some municipalities, the 25th will just pass by, month end will just pass by, but people are not getting their salaries. Can we get the report on that one?
Mine is on slide 17. I just want to understand. It talks about 27 provinces. Which are those districts? Can you name the districts and the provinces? Secondly, is in terms of the MIG. My colleague, I think, is correct to say most of the municipalities are using this municipal infrastructure grant for payment of salaries and so on. I think I will couple and make a follow-up. Did the department compile a list of all those municipalities that the department involved section 19? Which are those municipalities? Because in terms of the report, in terms of the department saying, those municipalities that are not in compliance, they are invoked section 19. Which are those municipalities? And so on. The last question is in terms of the senior managers. We are aware that in most municipalities there is that trend of a CFO is moved from one municipality to another municipality, move from one municipality to another, without even, you know, putting measures in place for that CFO. Be very difficult to make an application to another municipality. So, what is it that the department have put in place, you know, to prevent that?
Thank you, Chair, the honourable members, and officials. Mine is on two things. The first one is with the issue of the appointment of senior managers. That really, I will appeal that in municipalities where this exercise has not been completed, the department assists in finalizing the appointment. And I know that if it is difficult, you know, whether for the municipality to do that, why don't the provincial department take over the exercise? Because in any way, those particular posts are budgeted for. or even this department can also assist in checking over so that an appointment is made. You know, if the senior managers, you know, are not there, or one is not there, you must know that the work is not properly done. I know that there's provision of acting, and there are a lot of such municipalities in KwaZulu-Natal. And if you want a list, I can provide you as well. To say in this municipality, they have not finalized the appointment of senior managers. In this one, and it's been a long time. And also, I'm not sure about the rule, but I know that if the municipality, for example, has appointed the section 56 or 7, they must report to the MEC. Then the MEC will have his views and all that, you know, until when it comes to the idea nationally and so on. And I so wish that you can actually, you know, pay more attention in instances where the provincial government is a different political party and the municipalities are a different political party, because there seems to be fights. And I think, as you have mentioned in your report, in the future we'll be seeing more of court applications against that. I can give you some municipalities as well where there is that problem. And I know that one municipality has written to the former minister, and the former minister never even responded to that particular municipality. I can give you the name as well, if you need that. But secondly is that, please pay more attention on the issue of the VIP protection for councillors. I think somewhere it is being misused. I know, for example, of a municipality, that's Umhlatholi. In the benefits of councillors in the Gazette, that benefit is there for councillors. But there is a procedure that the municipality must develop in line with the Gazette to say, how do you do this? In that municipality, there's no procedure. You just come and say, no, I've been threatened. If the municipal manager or mayor really feels that you are threatened, they give you security. There is no police. From 2000, when there was the first mayor there, in fact, even this security thing was only meant, it was a resolution by then. But it has continuously been used that way without being having a policy. So I think Honorable Maluleka is correct to say that we must go and verify if municipalities are actually implementing that in line with the Gazette, because that could be money that is being used for services. Thank you, Chair.
And from our Kanzara, have a project there. Okay, but Matthew.
Yes, sir.
I'm a mayor. I tend to inform my car.
No, I just want to talk more about, I mean, a bit on this protection. You see, the department must be concerned if more mayors, municipal managers, and chief whips come forward to council and say we need protection. Really, you need to be concerned. To say why? Because some of these issues, this life-threatening, what you call, actions, they are informed by the fact that I don't want to name municipalities, but let me just give you this scenario. I get a contact from the municipality, I mean the contract, the tender. Then it's given to me. I didn't comply, but it's given to me. Then upon payment,
I must give part of the money back. Now, people are not the same. Some people just get the young boys and say, I've just given mayor so-and-so or municipal so-and-so this much of money. They come to the mayor's house in the evening, because they ask for that money. Remember, this is not a clean money. It's a kickback. Then the mayor down the line comes back. Yes, I'm telling you, the mayor comes back to council and say, please protect me. Instead of going to the police and report, she comes to council and say, please protect me. My life is being threatened. You see, this is a very big work for the department. To get these things, you know, to the bottom of this problem of corruption, it means, but these are some of the ways in which, you know, monies are just being stolen, money just go down the drain, unaccounted for. So, this person thieves money and comes back to the council and say, okay, protect me. I know of politicians at local level who've got to a budget of $1 million per month for protection. What are you protecting, man? Why should you be protected? Because now the municipality is losing double now. It's losing double. So this thing is very deep. It has got deep roots. You really need to work. No, it's not that much. I don't want to mention municipalities. I'm not going to mention specifics here. But, yes, I mentioned yes, because I'm not protected, you are right. But I am not protected. You see, so, really, there's a very big work for the department to do. We know how these people are actually looting. We know. So that is why I'm saying your report should have, you know, the big chunk of money that you are saying is not being recovered. Actually, it's the money that went down the drain. You see, money is stolen. In their report, they say we can't recover, but that is basically money stolen. If you want to get to the OJAC report and open it and check that section. The OJAC is saying so many millions unaccounted for. These are instances that you must follow up as a department. Thank you, Chair. Just wanted to amplify this.
Chair, thank you. My questions are actually follow-ups on my earlier question. So let's start with the unfunded budget. I then calculate 112 out of 257 municipalities have unfunded budgets. Now, that is contrary to Section 18 of the MFMA. So my question is, what is both DCOG and Treasury doing about this? What sanctions are you putting in place for those municipalities? Should you not say, we will stop your grant funding until you approve a funded budget? Because essentially these municipalities are spending money they don't have. So what is DCOG doing about it? My second question goes to a similar point, and that is, I spoke about financial recovery plans, and the response that I received, and I can't remember who it came from, was that the council draws up the recovery plan. But in terms of Section 1395 of the Constitution, and in terms of Section 139 and 140 and those sections of the MFMA, where there is a serious or persistent breach of financial obligations, the financial recovery plan must be drawn up by the Municipal Financial Recovery Service, and it must be adopted by council, and where council does not adhere to that plan, it must be dissolved. Now, what we're not seeing is that definitive action. We're not seeing that the MFRS is drawing up that recovery plan. We're not seeing that it's being adopted by council and adhered to by council, and we're not seeing that where it's not being adhered to, the council is dissolved and an administrator is put in place. So I'm throwing this back at you, DG. I'm going to be watching you for the next 18 months to see these dysfunctional municipalities. One, have they got a financial recovery plan that was drawn up by the MFRA? Have they adopted it? Are they adhering to it? And if they're not, why are they not being dissolved? And I'm going to hold you, Dr. DG, you and the minister, accountable for dissolving those municipalities, because it is a constitutional obligation. It's something that you have to do. I just want to come back to the draft declaration and ask that as soon as it is declared that we be informed of it, can you check on that and come back to us? And then just to my two colleagues' point about the recovery of expenditure, and particularly unauthorized, irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. Section 32 of the MFMA makes provision for the funds that are spent on irregular, unauthorized, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure to be recovered from those responsible. Now, if we're going to be serious about cracking down on corruption, we need to hold the individuals accountable. And we need to make sure that we recover the funds from those individuals. So if there's unauthorized expenditure, or if there's fruitless and wasteful expenditure, we must go after the individual who authorized it, whoever he or she may be, regardless of his or her political affiliation. We must nail those people and get the money back, because it is not their money, it is South Africa's money. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. That I think the department is here. I think they've taken note of many points. They will answer some of the points. DG, I think because we have been in local government more than 24 years now, I'm not sure what is new that you are talking about. Unless there's something new, it seems it's something that every year we are talking about. Every year, one and the same thing. I'm not sure we can turn around our cities and towns this way, anyway. I just guess that we should find a better way of managing this. Otherwise, what Honorable Melus was saying, that cities are playing a very critical role in in any society, since we are losing it completely. And I think we should find a way of what is new that you are saying in 2018. Because for the last 23 years, I know that Honorable Ngwezi, you were once a councillor also. You needed a security. They didn't provide you a security because your life was not in danger. Because you had no danger. No, but I do think that DG, because all of us, many of you, we have been part of local government for some time, we must try our level best to address really what is new that we want to do with local government. And because otherwise we end up with ourselves raising some of the issues that generally we have been raising. I think that MSC, we have been raising these matters for some time now. But it seems every year, I don't think we are satisfied about the answers, the work that we are doing to improve the situation. And I think we should find a better way. And surely DG will expect a lot from you and your team, especially because we have been deploying local government for some time. And I know that back to basic is one of the new ways that you wanted to do this. The second phase of it. I think we should find something more than what we are doing now. Otherwise, in 2019, 2020, until the end of the next term, surely, we are going to be doing exactly what we are doing. It must be very boring to you also. That is one and the same thing, one and the same thing. There's no report about what the progress that we are making. I would have thought that we'll reach a stage where I think the Gobashev will be able to say, these are cities in our country that are addressing the needs of the country. Two areas that we are addressing is poverty, unemployment, and and the other issue, I think, is under development, inequalities. And how are these big cities making a contribution to address this? Which cities that are doing well? Which cities complete? I'm not talking about small towns like the halfway station towns. I'm not talking about those ones that were created for stations. But secondary cities and metros, generally, we have some discussion about it. And then, in what way are they making contribution to the national demand? Which cities that are doing well? Which cities that they need push? Is Johannesburg doing well, Meltham, in addressing the three challenges? Or is there Pretoria, or Tswane, or Durban, whatever city, generally? Because otherwise, we are going to talk about this thing forever, generally. And I don't think it's assisting us anyway. I think the minister who's coming also is going to listen to this himself. He's going to leave again 2019, and another one comes in again. It seems we are not really moving the country forward. That's the point that I'm bringing. We are not removing the country forward, because it seems we are doing the same thing, the same way, the same thing, the same way. And then Meltham 2021 is still going to be in opposition, is going to be raising these issues again. New minister, new same issues. Mlungu Mnyama uzohamba nyambosa again. Same issues, same answers. And then SS fell also, pass on, same issues, same answers. Calvin, Gordon, same issues, same answers. It seems there's no way that we are progressing. I don't think we can build a country this way anyway. I think one way or another, Kovashev, we must find a better way of managing these issues, because I think this cooperative governance, traditional affairs, is a very important vote in our country, generally. Is an anchor department to propel development with society. Because we are managing towns and cities, rural areas, almost every corner of the country is managed by you, truly speaking. Let us find something that we are doing better. And then where we can add value, where we're not adding value. Is Polokwane doing well? Or is not doing well? Does it cover the issues that are worrying the society, integration of communities, poverty, inequality? It seems we are not addressing some of those issues. And then we end up with MIG. MIG funding, whether sports must have facilities. And I think some of them are very secondary issues, generally speaking. Unless we try to push it that way, maybe the third phase of back to basics will try to address some of those. Because I'm not sure what makes us a cover chef, that when you go to China, there are cities that are developing every day. I think we have been in China, I'm not sure how many times now. Trevor Fowler, another one, another one, another one. We have been going to China for many years. Every time you go there, at least you can see the changes in the city. Every time you come to Joburg, or maybe Joburg, I'm not sure, or Durban. You can't point the change that says this city is progressing. I think it's a big problem, you know. All of us now, we are grey, and we are grey now. We are still talking one and the same thing that we were talking prior, what was pre-interim, when you enter the pre-interim. I think you are going to leave local government grey, and we still talk about the same thing, but there's nothing that we can say. It's what progress that we have made to ensure that these big cities and towns, they are making contribution on poverty alleviation, they are integrating the society, better culture is developing. We are losing the bigger issues, and I think I'm not sure what we're going to do, but you can answer colleagues and assist us. Kovasha?
DG. Okay, Chairperson. The DDG will also attempt to answer some. but also a Fitzgerald. I think there was a very important question that was raised by Member Masondo, and he was referring to the President, even said something about the agricultural revolution. And but that also goes with the, because in our, we refer to the IUCF, Integrated Event Program Framework, which is the policy on planning and land use management and so on in the urban areas. But then, what he has said also says that, what was quoting the President, it also says that where you want to revolutionize the culture and so on, I mean, that talks to that is the primary industry where you have cultural land and so on. So the IUDF has to then say, because sometimes you may find that there's lopsidedness in favor of the urban issues and so on. But then how do we then cover those issues of the, you know, the agricultural land use and so on within the IUDF and so on? I think when we were in, and I'm sure DMLF can also address, when we were in Malaysia, Etiwini made a very good presentation and so on, but on planning and land use management in there. But what was interesting is that they were saying that they are actually, at Etiwini, they are about like 60% rural. Now, when you look at Etiwini, you don't see the ruralness and so on, but they said that they are, you know, up to that extent, rural. So how we then create that policy to say, here's a city, but certain portions are high density and so on and so on, but it's actually more rural than urban. So our policy, the IUDF and so on, we have to take those things into consideration, and therefore the act as well. Because once you estimate that you are 60% like rural, it means the rural part is also controlled by the Induna or the king and so on. So how do you navigate development in the soil? It's very interesting. Issues of effective leadership in the municipalities, indeed, that is the challenge even now, and we found that challenge lies in the interface, managing the interface between the political and the administrative leadership. Sometimes you just find that between the mayor and the MM, there's no chemistry, and therefore, you know, it just starts there, and then the whole ministry is there. So, and we think that if we could get into those programs of leadership development, which address the actual issues that are happening in the municipality. So sometimes you go to Stellenbosch or West University and there's a leadership development program, but it does it talk about the actual situation in the municipality, which is also political. They talk in general terms as if you're running some big corporate there and so on, but the nitty-gritties of the political admin interface in leadership, that is normally lost. Issues of corruption, I found that in the places where I was, it was also useful that we put a component in the ministry that just deals with ethics. So then you have a manager responsible for ethics in and. Now, one of the things that companies will be doing is to, from time to time, you hold workshops with the officials, because some of them will tell you, I didn't know that if I support my sister to come and join this municipality, that's corruption. You know, I didn't know that if I didn't say that I have some business that is in any some way related to what I'm doing, that is it. So we thought, before you even, while busting it, you bust the corruption, but you must also prevent it. So because of the ethics, you know, that ethics section, the department, was playing a very good role in preventing, making people understand that, by the way, this thing that you are doing is corruption, or it might amount to corruption or unethical behavior. So just to take people through that, because sometimes we take for granted that they understand, and I found that that was very workable, and we would encourage it in the within the municipalities. Another question was on what do we do with the municipalities that don't have a tech base? My knee jerk response was that why do we establish a municipality that doesn't have a tech base? Don't establish, because then it means to just design a dysfunctional municipality. Unless the treasurer would say, okay, the municipalities that don't have tech base, this is the grant that they will be grant funded. So if that is not the case, then why do you design a municipality that doesn't have a tech base? They don't have a revenue, so don't design it. So, you know, unless there's a... And then the issue of the abuse of the grant, I think that there is some way of monitoring as to what you do with the... We do that from as part of the better basis and so on. And I just think that, but we've also found that there are some very creative CFOs who would take it and use it before you even think of it, and then they continue, the project continues and so on. But, you know, that when you look, it's not they have not used it for anything. So you'll maybe take it in a month, and then knowing that, okay, but I'm going to take it back there quickly. So there are those, but those that outrightly just abuse it, there's consequences. The other thing is the salary, the COE, the compensation of employees as percentage of OPEX, the operational expenditure. And we believe that we must maybe make it a law, because at the moment it's just a norm that ideally, the salary bill must be at worst must be 35% of OPEX. You know, when we say you really, you know, but some municipalities are at 67%. You know, 67% of OPEX is salary. Now the remainder is so more money goes into salaries rather than service delivery. So we could make it a law that, look, it must be 35%. Otherwise, above that, then we have improper. There was an issue about maybe CFOs who do best things in one municipality, but you find them in another. Okay. When I was the municipal manager, I had created an institute, which is called the Institute of Municipal South Africa, South African Municipal Accounting Officer, which is really MM. So we created that institute, which is a professional institute. Now the aim was that you create standards for all the MM, so that if you don't do things according to those professional standards and ethics, there's no way you can be in Johannesburg and mess up and then you are found in a tabini, you know. So that body, like a law society of some sort. And you can be struck off the road, you know, so that you can't be an MM anywhere. We just strike you off the road of the MM. So that is created, it's a body that is there, but it may need more support, especially from COPTA. So that even with the CFOs, you know, you do that. You can't mess up here, and you know, you bungle those standards, then you are off. You are out of the system. So I think that would be the mayoral the VIP protection is in terms of the mayoral entry. So if anyone does it any other way, flouting the mayoral entry, because they are the ministerial and bigger national. So we have to do it according to that. But I think we would want to monitor the extent to which it's done to this. We must at the same time accept that the councillors, some of them do live in, I mean, we have had cases in Northwest, KZN, Mpumalanga, so on, where councillors basically get killed. So I think what we have done recently to try and say they need to be protected and so on, it was along those lines. But that is not for it to be abused. So I think, yeah. But
thanks.
Want to make intervention?
Yes, sir. Thanks, Chef. Just in addition to what the DGS indicated, we have put the mechanisms in place that it's no more permissible from one senior manager to hop from one municipality to the other. We have what we call a database that we keep, that is legislated, that the minister must keep a database of all senior managers found guilty of misconduct in municipalities. So, and it is a requirement that before an appointment can be made in any municipality, they must check with the National Department of Doctor whether that incumbent is in the database or not. So we are able to check whether the person was, each and every appointment is being made, is checked against the database that we have. So it was done before, but now we keep check of officials who have been found guilty, because there is a database and there is a time period that we call a cooling period that has been given for that person to be absorbed into the local government again. So we are able to check that. So maybe to explain that. Now, coming to the security of mayors and speakers and all other affected councillors. The minister published the notice for upper limits for senior managers on an annual basis. And the previous notice indicated that there should be a risk analysis being done before a decision can be taken to provide security for those councillors. In this year's notice, after consultation with SAUDA and all relevant stakeholders, and also as a result of the experiences that we had in Northwest and KZN, there was a suggestion made, a proposal made to the minister that we do the following, that we leave the provision that says there should be a risk analysis being done for security can be given to councillors. But we also differentiate between this ordinary councillors and mayors and speakers. And in this notice, it is provided that provisions shall be given to the mayor and the speaker. It did not provide the number of security officials to be provided. So that the provision still stands, that there should be a risk analysis, but with regard to the mayor and the speaker, once the mayor and speaker has been appointed, then there should be provision. We looked and we knew that there's going to be an outcry in relation to the number of security provided for mayors and speakers. The minister has since indicated to us that we need to make an amendment to the notice so that we give a number that has to be given. The agreement that has been reached with our political principal was that we are going to provide an amendment to this notice to say all mayors and speakers who will be then provided with security without a risk analysis shall have a driver and two security officials. That's the proposal put in place, so that we keep checks and balances as to the number provided for. But that is what was as a result of the proposal that was vehemently requested specifically from KZN and was in relation to the death that has been occurring there, and the minister felt at the time that we needed to provide that security for mayors and speakers. But there should be checks and balances in relation to that. The same as when we did when Mukhalakwena, where there was a number of security guards appointed, we intervened and said, well, you can't have this number. You can't have 18, you can't have 10. You should only be restricted to this particular number.
So that's what we have done. Just to clarify that it was intended mainly for protection, but it still remains with other councillors that there should be risk analysis done. The problem is that with this particular approach was that the councillors were saying, but it takes about 6 months for us to receive the risk analysis from the SAPS, and by that time someone is dead. So in the meantime, that you are awaiting this risk analysis whatever, why don't you make provision for the mayor and the speaker? That was the intention of us putting this in this year's notice. But we are working towards that aspect directive of our political response in relation to this. On corruption, I need to explain clearly the limitation that goes with this from the department perspective. When honorable members are saying that, what is the department doing in relation to corruption and all that? We all know that in December, the minister launched what we call an anti-corruption strategy in process through Jamie Marks Municipality now. That has to be adopted by all municipalities. So there is an anti-corruption strategy in place. Dr. Naidu will be presenting on the proposed amendments to the Special Act that also relates to the creation of MPEX that will have an oversight role in relation to the finances of the municipality. Internal audit in municipalities also play a major role in relation to that. But let's look at the limitations, the legislative limitations that we have as a department. The minister does not have the investigative authority. The minister can't even introduce or start what we call the investigative inspectorate as a department. As a department, we rely in relation to the active fighting of corruption on law enforcement agencies, and we also rely on the report that as a result of our intervention and requesting MEC in terms of Section 108 for them to conduct forensic investigations in municipalities. We rely on that, and once we have such cases, we can't further do that. We then hand them over to the law enforcement agency. As a result, the department itself can't go there and investigate and arrest and do whatever. Legally, we can't be doing that. But we have done something in relation to what we in response to this. I have already indicated we've got a database for all this new stuff. We've got an anti-corruption plan that we've developed, and we're going to monitor that it's implemented in municipalities. And also, on Tuesday, we are reporting to the committee in relation to the outcome and the analysis that you have done on the forensic investigations. And we will be telling you specifically what has been done, what the law enforcement agencies have done in relation to this matter, and what are the results that the people have scored off. So next Tuesday, we'll be reporting specifically on the analysis that we've made on the forensic investigations. So that's where the problem is at the moment in relation to. To what extent is the expectation of the department to be doing in actual fighting corruption? You can go as far as what I've already indicated now, and beyond that, legislatively you can't. That's the issue. Going back to the bloated organograms, we are aware of the high vacancy rate in relation to staff below Section 56 manager. We are also aware of, in some instances, the high number of people employed against the adopted organogram of the municipality. What we have done is to start now developing what we call a prototype organogram for different types and sizes and categories of municipalities. It should be finalized this financial year. We are at an advanced stage of saying no one-size-fits-all approach shall be then. We are going to have a particular organogram that is a prototype to be given to a municipality of a smaller size and other than that. So there is work being done to develop that particular organogram that also is in line with what the system success. Because no appointment can be made where positions are not in the structure, and we are now assisting them with developing those organograms. We went further, and we are also expecting to be finalizing these regulations for staff below senior managers to see to it that we have competencies standardized for all staff members below. We already have that for senior managers. We are now working on this. We are intending for the minister to gazette this competencies for all staff members that we have, actually having the same competencies in Trinidad and in the small village somewhere else. So we have done intensive work on that. We will be promulgating very soon so that we see to that municipalities do not appoint willingly and appoint incompetent people below senior managers. The last matter from my list is that in us monitoring the appointment of senior managers, the issue of the council belonging to being run by one political party, and we do not differentiate in relation to political parties being in power. The Systems Act makes it very clear what kind of people should be allowed to be employed in such positions. The approach that we have done is to develop a particular principle in relation to how we judge or we check whether this particular person is qualified to vote, irrespective of political affiliation and whatever. Now what we do, in instances where there is no compliance, we make the point that is pointed out, and it is pointed in specifically, either it is in relation to your qualification, in relation to your experience, or in relation to the transgression that you have committed. So the principle applies above board. It is not designed to favor one particular party to the other. And furthermore, in this approach, we see to it that the minister, remember that the minister of the NEC is not the employer of any staff member in the municipality. Us is just to say to the municipality, you have not complied with the regulations, take corrective measures. Remember, within 7 days, council must report to the NEC, and the NEC within 7 days must report to the minister on the process, not whether there is validity of on the process. And once we have said they must take corrective, council is the employer, must take corrective measures. When they do not take corrective measures, what we do is to say, then approach the court, which is treated for in the system set. We need to approach the court for a declaratory order, for the court to say, you as the employer, you have been advised by the minister of the NEC to take on the not. So irrespective of where it was, we have done that in all in other municipalities in KZN and in Western Cape and in the Northwest. On the financial recovery plans, I did give some explanation in relation to what we do, but going back to what the follow-up question is. This financial recovery plan are adopted by councils. I've indicated that we are now have moved to four provinces in making analysis whether this has been done. In instances where we are of the opinion that there has not been implementation, irrespective of the fact that they have been adopted by councils, but that's the first problem that we do. After ourselves and the National Treasury and the municipality have developed the financial recovery plan and they are adopted by councils, if they are not implemented, we'll do that analysis, and I said to honorable members that we'll come back and indicate that what will then be our next step. I didn't specify specifically what I meant by what should be the next step. The technical team that is going to municipalities affected by this, we will then be advising the minister whether to go through section 139 in relation for them not implementing this, but this will be done among other things. Whether one thing or
whatever. I have to interrupt you. I'm sorry, but the Constitution doesn't give you the right to decide what to do next. It tells you what to do next. Section 1395 and 1396 say that where a council does not implement a financial recovery plan, that council must be dissolved. That's what the Constitution says. There's no option here. It's the job of the minister to then dissolve the council. If they don't implement the financial recovery plan, that council must be dissolved. New elections and an administrator put in.
Yes, thanks for that, madam. I have indicated that we are doing what we call evaluation. We are going to four provinces. We are doing all the provinces. And that is only when we'll be aware or to come to a conclusion whether this has been implemented or not. And upon that, the next step will be taken. That's why I said I did not specifically indicate in relation to the 1-2-9-4 process. But I'm saying we are going to provinces now. We've already done certain provinces. And once we've come to the conclusion, then the next step will be taken. And I'm fully agreeable with you that what is the next step in instances where financial recovery plans have been done. At every stage, we've not done the analysis. We're in the process of completing the analysis. And once that has been done, then we'll be doing the next step that we are referring to. I think that's all in relation to the matter that we
the follow-up here. I think on the issue of municipalities employing more staff than the required percentage, I think the department is doing lifted on that matter. You know,
department is able to determine the number of councillors for a particular municipality, but it can't determine the number of staff. You know, with the Department of Education, for example, they will tell you that if you have got 300 kids, how many teachers must have in school, how many HODs, how many deputy principals plus principals. And I don't think that the Department of Education has more capable people, more than COGTA. I think it is possible with COGTA to actually determine that in a municipality where you have 33 councillors, this total number of whatever, this budget, you should have at least approximately this number of employees of the municipality. I think that is possible. So I wanted to actually, you know, check if that is possible. But to me, I think it is possible. But lastly, on the issue of you know, this thing of the VIP protection for councillors. You know, I think councillors or SALDA is correct when they say, if I get a threat today, I still might escape that today. People come and shoot me, I escape. I report to the council. From the date of the, you know, the threat until the date of the arrival of the risk assessment, you are actually waiting for death there. And you know, when they say it takes 6 months, they are lying. For me, it took 18 months. It took 18 months. In fact, I had to leave. I left. It came the week after when I had left to here.
Oh,
you know. So, you know, I'm talking about something that I know. You know, you have to stay, do your work, hygiene, and all that, you know. So, what I was thinking is that perhaps, you know, where they are visible, you know, visible threats, you know, council must be allowed, if there is budget, you know, either to have whatever or whoever, you know, starting that councillor, you know, whether on month-to-month basis, you know, to say that if the risk assessment comes and say something else, you know. I think they are correct. Because, or else if something can be done, that no, these assessments are not sent to the provincial commission. They are given to district or region, you know, whatever the hierarchy of the SIPS may be. Because there, when you call to do some follow-up, they will tell you that I'm still, maybe you are number 1,002. We are still busy with the others, you know. So it is centralized, the system is centralized. So if maybe it can be decentralized, you know, things can be a little bit quicker compared to the system that is currently being used now.
Honorable members and chairperson, there is no law that matters stand that gives or empowers the minister to determine the number of staff in municipalities. What we have done, in actual fact, is this approach of us developing a prototype of monogram for different categories and sizes of municipalities. Remember that once we have your monogram, the monogram will be in a way trying to regulate whether these small municipalities with this organogram can have such more or less the number of employees in it. But that makes sense. The system set only provides for the measure to harmonize conditions of employment in municipal staff. So that's my answer to that. We are working towards finalizing the development of a prototype of monograms for different categories of municipalities, and that will be in a way of rectifying the problem. But as matter stands, the law does not empower him to determine the actual number of employees in municipalities. I agree with you the second point. If there is going to be an amendment in relation to that, I'm speaking to lawmakers now, then lawmakers can consider that. But on the second matter, I agree with you that the input that we receive from provinces and municipalities is especially that one. That says before you could even receive the risk analysis, someone is dead or so. But the issue is the police, as matters stand now, are the only people who can provide this risk analysis. That is genuine and credible. and municipalities do not even have any resources to do an independent risk analysis on the person complaining about this and that. In response to that, the minister had a meeting with the DG, not the minister, the DG at the time had a meeting with the National Commission of Police, where we implored upon them to assist us with the following. Speeding up the process of receiving this risk analysis, once the employers requested that, and also in relation to assisting us with the development of the criteria that should be there to determine the vehicles that are befitting mayors and speakers. We are now awaiting the response from them in relation to give us specifications in relation to that, and they have made it a point that they will speed up the process of finalizing the risk analysis. We are in engagement with the police for them to give us a shorter period of the response once the municipalities have requested that. Hence, the request from KZN and Northwest that with regard to mayors, because they are at the conflict, they should be the ones who will be provided. What we are going to do to strengthen that particular clause in the notice is to give the actual numbers in the relationship.
Chairman, I think we have requested before the issue of discussing with SALCA to schedule with us the issue of killing of customers. I think this part of land that you are discussing, we can discuss it much better after getting that report and engage it there. Because we are dealing with it haphazardly currently. I don't feel because we know of some towns where every councillor is being having a VIP protection and all those things. And we know of the of provinces chair that a number of councillors have been killed as well. And then getting to this issue of protection, I don't think we might be discussing it correctly now by putting the formulas and what the department secretary is doing. I want to propose here that why don't we shelve this issue to discuss it with SALCA first and understand that killing of councillors, what is the really causing that? And then we can go deep down to even analyze whether are we also recommending as a committee to say, no, look, non-councillors must be provided with VIP protection, or we say this is too much after getting the analysis of that report. I think, Chair, for now, why don't we shelve that item? That's my proposal, Chair.
Okay, comrades, colleagues, we must try to move. The report, anyway, SALCA report has been presented as general. I think it's open. All the causes of killing of councillors, I think they've explained exactly what are the causes of this. But I thought that the issue of the risk assessment is an issue that you are raising with. And that took long, but I think the department is in interaction with the police. I think they will resolve some of the issues there. And I think it's fine, and then we'll make follow-up on some of the issues that have been raised. We can see then what we can do. So, we just am aware that other meetings are taking place also that we have to attend. Yes,
sir. Yeah, so I just wanted to make a, I think it's a practical solution to the problem, understanding the industry of where councillors come from and where security issues come from. Lucha, sometimes one must put it bluntly and say, some of the stuff, if it's not fed by a committee like your committee, a portfolio committee or local government, it takes time for it to carry weight on the ground. And we need to be fair and be realistic as a people before we become portfolio holders, as officials, or as politicians, that when you want to go and conduct a risk analysis, you are then saying that you and your family are on your own, in spite of the risk for those who are customers who understand that. My suggestion, Chair, is that we'll then table it through the Deputy Minister is here and through to the Minister and make a suggestion that when a councillor is appointed as a mayor or speaker and chief with standard, they get protection. Without any risk assessment. Some of them don't even live in their community. My suggestion is that, and I was saying to my DG, out of 10, when a councillor makes a report to the council or submits that my life is under threat, whilst the risk analysis is being carried out, at least minimum security should be provided. Because just in 1 year, we've lost almost 30 councillors. If we speak of KwaZulu-Natal, it was like councillors were dying like flies. Because we were still analyzing the risk, which then means we put them in this position, and then we doubt their genuineness in terms of them reporting the risk. So I'm just saying, when it comes from a committee like yours, it's a strong recommendation to us. It makes more sense, because when the deputy minister and the minister suggested, sometimes it's viewed as, they don't care about the fiscal. Money is going to be wasted. But the reality is that we have buried enough councillors to understand that when I say my life is in danger, I mean, there are officials whose lives are also in danger at the municipal level. The risks are not only for councillors. So the reality is that upon reporting, make sure that at least the voice is heard from your side at an oversight level to say, take responsibility as the South African Police Service. Provide minimum support and protection up until such time that you have done your analysis. By the time you have done your analysis, we shall have had the funeral and the grave shall have sunk down anyway. Thank you.
Okay, no, the point is made, really. Surely those who deal with these issues of security, they must be dealing with it, and we'll deal with it ourselves. Have some discussion with the ministries and other colleagues, SACA, and see what else we can do to ensure that we avoid this killing of councillors. It seems at the moment you stop a little bit now, quiet. It may start again, but I think it's a little bit quiet now. Councillors really dying almost every week, and I think it was a bad situation. Okay, now we take the point and we try to work on that. Honorable Matsika, we'll work it out and see what we can do. Honorable Nell is here. As we meet, again, we'll have some discussion about these issues. Yeah, I think we are right in where the gap is too big. If your life is in danger, surely you must act accordingly. And another thing can be done accordingly, but take time. We mustn't allow people to die. Okay, no, that's fine, colleagues, on this one. The briefing, I think, was useful. Not the end of the engagement with the department. We have to engage them also on some of the program that is there on our name, how we integrate our cities, how we turn our cities to be centers of economic activities, booming cities. Of course, South African cities, all of them, they sleep like us anyway, generally speaking. If we are around the year on our late, we can see that the city is dead, generally, because all of us, we go and sleep in some dormitories far away from the city. Cities that sleep are not 24-hour cities, well, our cities that sleep because of the planning of apartheid that caused so much harm. The bigger issue yesterday, I think Kruneval should come also and assist us to understand that. And we should address some of these issues. I hope that the team that was meeting here on Abunet is about those issues. That the cities must be 24-hour cities. No cities that you can't walk unless to Parliament late because you can be robbed here, some forces, because it's dead in general. At least if you go to the touch, you can enjoy a bit. Even there, it's dead anyway. Our cities, they sleep, they wake up at 5 in the morning, like us. They are not very good cities to make money, they are just dead cities. I think it's a big problem. Melhem, I know that you want to be mayor of Cape Town.
No,
okay. We'll be a good mayor because I think the city will start having 24-hour lights and making money for 24 hours. Okay. No, I think we are fine on that. And then we are going to work it out.
Honorable Ned, from time to time you brief the committee about the new development on the issue that you are, on the item that you are leading in terms of integration. Every time I think we'll keep the committee informed in general about the progress we are making in terms of the team that is working on it. I think the one issue now that is left is the yes, sir.
Thank you very much. If I may, and I don't want to rob the committee of time, but I would like just again formally to tender my very sincere and heartfelt apologies for what happened this morning. Really, I think it was a serious breakdown in communication. I had been informed that the venue had relocated. I was only informed, I got a message about after about 45 minutes that the members of the committee had been waiting. I've indicated that it's completely unacceptable, and again, I apologize without reservation. Secondly, I think just to convey the best wishes of Minister William Kieser, I think you might know that he's attending his inaugural cabinet meeting this morning, and hence he was not available to attend. But I'm sure that we had a lengthy meeting last night, and he indicated that he would, without any waste of time, want to meet the portfolio committee. And hopefully that will happen in the very near future. Just last to say that my own apologies, I had scheduled a meeting of the Integrated Urban Development Framework Political Steering Committee. The urgency of that meeting arose out of the fact that last week we did a presentation on IUDF to a joint sitting of all cabinet committees. The presentation was very, very well received. One of the recommendations that was agreed to was that all departments should embed the IUDF in their programs and their work. The feeling, though, in the meeting was that that recommendation didn't go far enough. It's not strong enough, and we were given a very clear marching order to come back to cabinet as soon as possible with much more concrete, much more strong recommendations with regard to the implementation modalities for the IUDF. Hence the speed with which we needed to meet. So our apologies for not being able to be here, but we were attending to the very matters of concern that you were about. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and can we move to our second item? The Structural Amendment Bill.
Yes, the decision will be done by Dr. Leon.
Okay.
Thank you, DG. The presentation that we have is going to basically paint a background as to how we've arrived here. The way we've also structured the presentation is that we deal with it at a very high level initially, and then we go down into the detailed proposal, but I think the latter way of giving the detail may be deferred because of time constraints, so I'll give you a presentation on high level proposed amendment, and then to recommend to the committee to note and to discuss the amendments that we have before us. I think I should also say that the bill has formally been introduced into Parliament by the Minister. As part of the presentation, we've also included members, the bill itself, as well as the memorandum on the objects of the bill. And as part of the attachments thereto, we've also included the various certifications that we've received from DPME, the Social Economic Impact Assessment Study, as well as the certifications from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. The next slide indicates what we had communicated to the Leader of Government Business in 2016, which essentially said that by the end of the calendar year last year, we would introduce the bill into Parliament, and which indeed has been the case as I've indicated earlier. So just by way of background, the amendments that have been included in the bill mostly related to initially proposals that we had received from the IEC, and which proposals indicated or proposed changes to improve administration and management of local government elections. At the bottom of that slide, you would notice that the organic nature of local government, with specific reference to by-elections that we had had, and to indicate that in 2000, for that entire five-year term, we had 60 by-elections. In the following term, we had 54, and then spiking in the third term, where we had 741 by-elections. To date, in the present term of local government, we have had 116 by-elections as at the middle of this month. So, just further by way of background to indicate that the initial bill that we had gotten approval to publish in the Government Gazette was informed by those proposals around bias around IEC amendments. But when we had published it for comment, there were two major areas of controversy that was raised, and that was firstly the amendment of Section 2 of the Structures Act, which dealt with the identification of metropolitan areas, and secondly a proposal therein where we had suggested that the norm for deviating when determining the number of councillors be changed from 15% to 20%. Suffice it to say that since the publication of that version of the bill, we have excluded those two controversial provisions. In the bill that we have presently before us, it's informed by a more expansive approach that we have taken in terms of what would inform the bill, and which in the main was informed by proposals that had been made over a two-day workshop that we had had, including various stakeholders, and those stakeholders are included on the slide that you see before you. We also say what we had done in terms of compliance from the month of June towards the middle of October last year. And then we show the three broad areas in terms of how we've categorized the amendments to the that we have in the board. So firstly, we have categorized it into electoral amendments, as I indicated earlier, sponsored by the IEC. We have five slides towards the end of the presentation dealing specifically with these electoral related matters, and at that point I will invite our colleague from the IEC to speak to those amendments. The second area of amendments that we have relate to governance-related amendments, and we speak about, firstly, the abolition of the plenary type of municipality to use as a criterion the geographical area to determine the number of councillors in a municipality. We deal with the functions of speakers. We deal with the amendments, the creation of the Office of the Whip. We deal also with the creation or the establishment, as indicated by the previous presentation, the creation of the Municipal Public Accounts Committee, the Section 79 Committee, and then matters relating to forums and decisions. The third area that we've identified or clustered the amendments deal with other matters, and these deal with the abolition of reference to district management areas, migration of certain provisions from the Structures Act into the demarcation bill that we are still developing, and then to deal with the migration from the Systems Act of the Code of Conduct for Councillors into the Structures Act. So, the electoral related amendments are indicated or provided for in the various sections that we've highlighted on that slide before you, and then still dealing high level the identification of the various governance-related amendments. So just to speak to the abolition of the plenary-type municipality, you will notice that in the relevant slide, we remove reference, or we delete reference to those types of municipality by deleting certain provisions in Section 7, 9, and 10 of the Act. We talk about those municipalities affected by introducing the size of municipality when determining the number, and also the implications of proposing a minimum of 15 councillors as that which would then be applicable in a local municipality. We talk about a councillor not being eligible to stand as councillor again after a cooling off period, the designation by the MEC of a person to call a meeting when the speaker or acting speaker refusing to do so, and then, as I indicated earlier, quorum, the casting vote of a presiding councillor, strengthening of the role of the speaker, etc., as provided in the detailed provisions of the proposed amendment. So if I can go then to slide 15, which then deals with the detailed proposal. Then section 1, in the definitions part of the bill, we speak about introducing a term or definition of declared elected. And this is based mostly because presently, without such a definition, there's three interpretations as to when a council is declared elected. The first would be the election date. The second would be the date of publication of the results of an election by the IEC. And then some councils interpreting it to be the date of the first council meeting. In the bill that we have before us, we have indicated that the second option, that is the date of publication of the results of the election by the IEC, would be the date that would be applicable when determining the declared elected date by all municipalities across the country. Section 6 deals with district management areas, and this is for essentially neatness, as the district management area concept has been removed. We do not have any DMAs in the country any longer. As I've indicated earlier, Section 17, 9E, 9F, and 10C of the Act would be deleted to remove reference to a plenary-type municipality. Section 12 and Section 16 are presently providing a duplication of certain provisions in the Act. And for neatness, we say that that duplication should be deleted and that the provision that would be remaining would still provide the essence of what is required in those sections. Section 20, as I've indicated earlier, we say that in a municipality of more than 20,000 square kilometers, an MEC may deviate by 20% if less than 35 councillors are determined by the formula that the minister determines in this case. So by way of example, we've indicated which would be those nine municipalities that would be affected if such a provision would be implemented. And you would see that most of these municipalities reside in the Northern Cape, one in the Northwest, and then one in the Western Cape. Albert Cooper being the largest municipality with 44,000 square kilometers, and just by way of example, the Gauteng province in its entirety would fit twice into Albert Cooper local municipality. If one has to then look at implementing the minimum of 15 councillors in a municipality, we would find that 40 municipalities would be affected, and those 40 municipalities are indicated in the ensuing slide. We've indicated the following seven municipalities that fall into that 15 minimum councillors category as well. So section 30 deals with quorums and decisions, and this is basically to provide confirmation as to the number that should be used when determining what the quorum should be in a municipality, and that is basically the number that is determined by the MEC in the section 12 notice, which indicates the number of councillors, amongst other things. We also provide or read in the words, other than the matter mentioned in section 162 of the Constitution, and which relates to a constitutional court matter that was brought before the court by the Western Cape government back in 2015. The next section dealing with qualifications for councillors, and we say that if a person is removed from office by an MEC, that councillor may not stand as a candidate in an election for any council for a period of 2 years from the date on which such person was removed from office. This has been included in the amendment mostly because there were instances where councillors were removed from office only to find such councillor moving on to another council and becoming a councillor. This section 22 is actually an expansion of the declared elected provision that we have defined up front. The next slide deals with section 25, by-election, and we indicate here that the MM must inform the MEC and the IEC of a vacancy within 14 days. The next section deals with section 29, and I've alluded to this earlier on, which says that a person designated by the MEC to call a meeting in the event that a speaker or acting speaker refuses to do so. Section 29A, we propose to be a new section, which is the migration of section 19 from the Systems Act into the Structures Act, which deals with notice of meetings of municipal council, and we say that this migration of the provision is a better fit within the scheme of provision as we find itself in the Structures Act. Section 37 deals with providing further functions for the Speaker of the Council, and the proposal is to further strengthen the role of the Speaker in a municipality. An amendment of Section 41 to provide for a new Section 41A for the creation of the Office of Whips of Municipal Council. You would know that presently we have no departing provision in the structures as to deal with this specific office bearer, and we believe that the creation or the provision of these amendments would regularize the matter of the office of the whip in municipalities. Section 43 deals with the composition of executive committees, and this provision deals mostly with some of the inconsistencies that we have presently in terms of how EXCOs are formulated. So we're proposing in this section that a uniform formula be applicable throughout the country so that we do not have instances where different municipalities use different formula. We want to remove the word or replace the word elect with determine, and also to give political parties or political interests the latitude to identify which persons from their own political parties should be part of the EXCO. What we hear presently happening is that the majority party in a council would dictate to smaller parties whom they should appoint into the executive committee. So in instances they would ask that you appoint that, let's say, less competent councillor into the committee so that that councillor could be manipulated by the majority council. Section 44 deals with the powers and functions of EXCO. So presently the provision says that reports should be submitted to committees of the council, and here we're making the point that only reports from Section 80 committees should be submitted to EXCO and to the executive mail in Section 56 of the Act. Section 73 deals with the establishment of ward committees, and we're introducing a time frame for when municipalities must establish ward committees, and we say that that should happen within 120 days, except in extenuating circumstances where it is not possible. And such an instance arose in the last local government election when Ward 2 could not form its council for various reasons. Section 79 deals with the establishment of the MPAC, the Municipal Public Accounts Committee, and you will see that link or cross-reference is also made to the MFMA in this section. We believe that this introduction of the MPAC would further strengthen governance in municipalities, but importantly we say that reports of the MPAC must be submitted to the Speaker, who must table such reports into the next meeting of the Council. What we see presently happening is that, for various reasons, reporting of these committees are blocked or not tabled in Council, which results in certain things being swept under the carpet. The next section deals with Section 85.4, which is not provided in the bill, but it has been requested by the Demarcation Board, that all of the provisions in the Structures Act relating to their function and mandate be migrated from the Structures Act into the Demarcation Bill. So this would be dealt with when the Demarcation Bill would be amended. So it stays as it is presently until such time that the Demarcation Bill is being developed. The same would go for Schedule 1, Part 1 of the of the schedule, and this deals with criteria that the board must consider when delimiting wards. So this will also happen when the demarcation will be developed. The next section then deals with the Part 3 and Item 16, excessive seats, and I think I want to invite my colleague Graham Granville to speak to those provisions.
Thank you, Dr. Nader. Honourable members, if I could take you through the first one and then just give an overall overview of the rest. The first one I want to deal with in isolation, that is item 16, and it deals with the concept of excessive seats, and I may need to give some explanation. The Constitution in section 157 says that our system needs to be overall a PR system, a result in a PR. However, it does make provision for wards as well, and thus we have the MDB. Now, if a voter votes, uses these two ballots to vote for the same party, then we don't have a problem. But because your vote is your secret and you are entitled to vote for whoever as a voter you want to, we have a situation that may occur where a voter may vote for one party on his ward or for an independent on the ward ballot, but on the PR ballot he may vote for a different party. Now, the formula for the calculation of seats in line with the Constitution is, first and foremost, we tally both ballots, the PR ballot and the ward ballot, and we determine the overall PR allocation. A party would then have its ward seat deducted, and what remains is actually PR. So PR does not specifically relate to a ballot. It is the total of the two ballots as a proportion. Now, what can happen
And incidentally, it happened as recently as last year at Metsimaholo, in a by-election where the entire municipality was dissolved. It is possible for a party to receive, to win more ward seats than its overall proportional allocation. And when this happens, we have a situation what we call excessive seats. Now, obviously, the one award, which is based on first past the post, we can't take that away. What the formula proposes is the practice that we've done currently is to take that seat away from the overall, to take that party's seat out of the calculation and then get the remaining parties in a similar formula to contest for all other seats that remain. So what we're proposing here is basically to legislate that practice. The other alternative, and this we did the very first time this happened, but then I'm a bit surprised it wasn't challenged. That was illegal. We just created an additional seat, and the IEC can't create additional seats. That is the determination of the number of seats is for the NEC, and my reading is that the determination of seats
is confession time.
Yes, the determination of seats also determines the number of council, the number of wards, and therefore also the entire electoral base system. So it is not something that can be done afterwards. So we tried both, but the first one obviously is something that is not provided for in legislation. It's a mathematical formula, and as I said, this has been the practice. It was challenged now in Metsimaholo, where it was asked for the MEC to create additional seats. The MEC in the province says, I have no more discretion. I've already used up all of that discretion. But I think that discretion is also time-bound, as I've mentioned, in the determination of wards. That is the most difficult one. The others will go quick. Essentially, we're dealing here with the rest of the items to deal with PR vacancies, councillor vacancies, the PR ones. I think Kevin has dealt within the main body of the Act on ward councillors, ward by-elections. This one deals with PR vacancies and also the maintenance of PR list, candidate list. The first one, just as a matter of expediency, we say that we're now giving parties an ultimatum of 2 days to supplement their list when their existing list has been depleted. So if a party has only two candidates on this list and they win three seats, PR seats, then we're giving them 2 days, 48 hours. And the reason for that is we have to publish the list of final council. Otherwise, they're going to hold up ransom, and there's nothing within this legislation that we can have to rush them on. The following one is specifically regarding PR councillors. We're saying we want to amend the reporting period for the managers, the municipal manager to report a vacancy. Currently, it is 7. And one of the difficulties that we found is, especially where a councillor has died, that you want to give the family some space and you don't want to come with your administrative issues of rushing them for a death certificate. Because it is one of the requirements just to ensure that we have exercised due diligence that the vacancy as a result of death is actually supported by a certificate. So just to give them more space in terms of that. We are also saying that the municipal manager, if he does not inform the IEC, under by-elections for wards in the main body of the Act, it is specifically contained there that if the municipal manager does not inform the IEC, then the MEC must. There is no such provision in PR vacancies, so we are just aligning that to say that if the municipal manager fails, then that responsibility passes on to the MEC in the province. Part 3, on the filling of vacancies, currently, as it currently stands, it says a party may amend its candidate list at any time, and the specifically dealing with the PR list. That is problematic for us because the Electoral Commission also has the responsibility to publish an election timetable, and in that timetable it sets cut-off dates for candidate nomination. So it is our view that to amend this will be in line and to protect that the timetables of for a general election, that this clause is basically has to be put on hold, and therefore we say that they may not supplement or change its list from the date of the close of candidate nomination, but after that, after the election and once council has been appointed, then once again they can do it any time. But it should not interfere with a final list of candidates that voters would have to be would have to vote on. Just another way of putting it, if we had allowed it to be changed at any time, then a party may submit a list now that we publish for the electorate, but by the time we appoint them, it could be replaced by a totally different list. So we also see it as potentially undermining the electorate as well. Then Schedule 2. Now Schedule 2, I'm basically going to be repeating all of the things I've already mentioned, because Schedule 1 deals with Category A and B municipalities, and Schedule 2 deals with district councils. So once again there we mentioned the 2 days to supplement the list, and once again also the fact that a party may not change its list to align it to candidate nomination, and yeah, that's basically it. And then in Kevin, I think we're back with you. Schedule 7.
Yeah, so I've already mentioned that we intend migrating the Code of Conduct from the Systems Act into the Structures Act, mostly because it's the better fit in terms of the greater scheme of the provisions in the Structures Act. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry, President, on behalf of the Chair, sorry, he has just attended to another meeting. I will continue on his behalf. So, members, this is the presentation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I've got a couple of questions. The first one relates to the proposed amendment to Section 20. And I'm going to use Karoo Hoogland as an example. We're going to increase that to 15 councillors for 7,000 voters, which effectively means that you're going to have 800 voters per councillor, 700 voters per councillor, more or less. It's a ridiculous situation when the norm is about between 7,500 and 12,500, roughly, in most situations. And yet, because of this increase, you're going to have roughly 700 to 800 voters per councillor. I just think that's going to be problematic. Then, with regard to, you proposed migrating Section 19 of the Systems Act into the Structures Act, and I would have thought that Section 20 should come as well, which is public admission to meetings. But that's just a thought. On Section 37, one of the issues that comes up time and again is the lack of impartiality of the speakers. And I would have thought that there should be a clause in here that says the speaker must act in an impartial manner that does not show fear or favor to any individual or party. Then, with regard to the introduction of Section 79A, one of the SELGA guidelines is that, and I think it's also one of the Association of Municipal Public Accounts Committee recommendations, is that MPACs be chaired by a member of the opposition. And I would have thought that this would be an opportune time to amend this clause to bring that in here. Then also, just while we're talking about Section 79 generally, there should be a clause in here that mirrors what you've done in the section about executive committees, about the composition or the appointment of councillors. In other words, that parties have the right to choose who they nominate. It's not in Section 79 that when the committee is selected, they can put up whoever they want as their candidate. And I would have thought that should come in as well. And I think that's pretty much it for now. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is general. That I just want to check and understand what causes the fluctuation in terms of by-election as from 2000 up to date. Because you see the numbers are increasing each year. What causes it? That is the assassination of candidates, or what are the causes really in terms of analysis? But also the second question is in terms of the impact the chairperson in that particular municipality. Because currently the arrangement is that the majority elect the chairperson. Now, in terms of the duties and the responsibility of the impact the chairperson, it is very clear that as a person, you cannot hold the fund into the wasteful expenditure of that municipality. Is there any possibility or is there any way of trying to achieve his position of an MPEC chairperson, you know, to be an administrative, for example, or to be in the form of, you know, enforcing that should not be the majority that have a chairperson, or any person even from the opposition can lead that, so that they were able to investigate with their committees freely, without interference, and so on. You know what I mean. But in this situation, or the current arrangement, I think it is not going to assist us in making sure that in the certain municipalities there is accountability, you know, in terms of using of the funds and so on.
Thank you. On page 11, I don't have the number of the slide. I think maybe it's 22. On the proposed amendment on section 20, can you clarify me for number 15, Tokoloko Municipality? Why does it have 8 councillors but have the same ward with the other municipalities that have 7 councillors?
Okay, thank you. Any more other question? No, over to you.
Thank you. Let me start with the last question. So, when you look at the provisions in the Structures Act and the determination of number of wards in a municipality, the provision states that the number of wards in a municipality is 50% of the number of councillors determined by the MEC. So 50% of 8 is 4, 50% of 7 is 3.5. So the law says that in that event, we need to round it off upwards. So the 3.5 says that you need to have 4 wards in such a municipality. So to come back to Honorable Mileham and the 700 to 800 per councillor, So how do we strike a balance between deepening democracy, limiting the size or area for a councillor to serve? It's a difficult one to really respond to, because you would find that as we even look at Kerua, Auckland, and the 7,000 odd voters there, to maintain a 15% norm in those various wards, if we keep the number as little as four wards, it's going to be difficult, Honorable Myanam. So I think we need to measure that against how we deepen democracy, how we deal with financial implications, etc., etc., on this specific matter. So, I mean, the Northern Cape is a province that has been for years now trying to the department, trying to various stakeholders to say or to ask how better we make it more accessible for citizens to access their public representatives. I mean, I indicated earlier that Gauteng fits twice in Durban Trepa. I'm the city of Joburg, so 270 councillors in square area of 1,600 or 1,800 square kilometres compared to 30-odd councillors in 44,000 square kilometres. So we need to find a balance, and our view is that, you know, the provisions that we have before us seems to find a balance between size and number of councillors and deepening democracy. So we take also that perhaps Section 20 and 19 should be migrated from the systems to the Structures Act, as well as then improving on Section 79 in respect of how the MPAC is composed in relation to, or in a similar fashion as the EXCO is composed, and as we have indicated in the revised provisions that we would like to see in the Structures Act. Then the person that chairs the MPAC, I know, Honorable Myelam, you asked this question in the National Assembly at least once before, and I think I'm going to leave it there as well and see how, when it comes to defining those provisions, we deal with. I think it's more a political response than a response that you would want from an official. Fluctuation in by-elections, I'm going to ask the colleague from the IEC to respond to that. And perhaps also, sir, the issue around the impact that you raised as well. When the opportunity arises again, I think we should leave it for when we come to that engagement.
Okay.
Thank
you for the question. Maybe just at the outset say that I haven't got a scientific study to rely on, but since all of these things have been coming across my desk over the last 20 years, I can share with you what I've seen. I think initially when it came to by-elections, and even for your PR vacancies as well, the main cause was death. And one could probably even go and analyze the cause of death as well, because at one stage, and no correlation, no study, but the cause of death was, or the incidence of vacancies and death could also be linked in the early years to the pandemic that we had not had under control at that stage. And then obviously also resignation. And I would term that, as a counselor, as being natural causes for a vacancy. You either die or you resign. Of late, however, I think that it's taken on a different nature. Yes, people are still dying. We are also have seen an impact of the councillor assassinations also coming through here, but not to the extent that it's been a big cause. But it's been a cause of death, obviously. The two issues, however, that dominate. When we have a dissolved council, we count each and every ward, so that's why the numbers are also higher. So we don't count a dissolved council as one. So in the case of Metsimaholo, they had 20 odd wards.
So that would count as 22 and not one, because there was 22 councillor vacancies, and then obviously also the both ballots were involved in. But we counted as 22. The other issue, both for ward councillors as well as PR councillors, is internal party dynamic, dismissals, leadership disputes within your smaller represented parties, whether it's now ward as well as PR. So those are the basically the issues that's coming, but primarily, because in the last 2 years, 2 or 3 years, we've had Mutu, we had Metsi Maholo, we also had Matuba Tuba, we had the case of Klokwe, we had the dismissal, the initial by-election was six wards, I think, all in dynamics, all within one municipality. So it's taken on a totally new nature, and gathering from the discussion there, I think one can probably anticipate going forward it's only going to get more.
Okay, thank you very much. But the other concern was that maybe the reflection of the numbers here is really sometimes confusing, because you do like a municipality that has been disbanded, you count it as 20. If there is a council there, you count it as one. So that's why these numbers, sometimes it doesn't give really a sense of what is exactly happening. Because a municipality that has been disbanded, we must count it as one. Yes, it's disbanded once, and then if then the councillor resigned or anything happens for those reasons, then it must be 2, 3, 4. Maybe it might remember to give a sense of what is exactly happening in that meeting. Otherwise, thank you very much for the presentation. I'm not sure whether anybody wants to do some follow-up on the answers that has been given. Now, if that is known, then members, we've got the presentation, we've asked questions and we've dealt with. Maybe let me give it to the DG to say the few words before the DM to come in, and then close our meeting.
No, from my side, just want to thank you very much for this full engagement and with my family, and I'm looking forward to a very productive relationship for the committee.
Thank you. Ian?
No, Chairperson, I think once again, just to thank the committee for the ongoing productive engagement that we enjoy with you, for the oversight work that you do. Sometimes you might not think that we appreciate it, but I can assure you that we really do value that engagement. And we, as we said earlier, we hope that Mr. Nkize will have the opportunity to engage with the committee in the very near future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members. Also, we're looking forward for the report that we'll be getting for next week, which will highlight some of the issues, critical issues that has been already alluded to our meeting today. And this meeting, then again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Number and email.
Thank you.